So we have about 10 minutes for questions. We've seen the process of green growth, green economy emerging around the world, and the opportunity for a seat at the table. We know Riego and the representatives of the different informal sectors wanting a seat at the table. Let's start to have a few questions for Marty and the years of knowledge she has brought from Riego. Any questions? Hi. Camilla.
Yes, thank you very much. My name's Camilla Tallman, former director of IID and now senior fellow. Really good to meet you finally, because I've heard a lot about you. Two quick questions. One is this an agenda for national government or rather for municipal government? And second question is, having worked a lot on land rights and seeing the huge cost and unwieldy process of cadastral surveys and the formalization of undocumented land rights, there's a lot of experimentation with sort of simple, cheap, halfway processes of rights registration, which might also play out quite well in the informality field, because there could be some useful crossover in terms of learning.
Thank you. Answer that one? Yes. Okay. Thank you, Camilla. On the first, we do have to work at all levels. It's very important, you know, global discourse, the debates in international agencies are hugely important, the donor community. National governments have, and the relationship of national governments to local governments, there are different jurisdictions depending on the countries. So we find we have to work at all the different levels. But for the urban informal workforce, of course, the most immediate force that they face every day in terms of, there's at least one eviction every day of street vendors around the world, is the local government. In terms of land rights, from our experience, there are two issues. One is on informal settlements and where they live, but also work. We also have found that trying to go the formal route of working through all the complexities of urban land is very, very difficult. And perhaps you're just in an endless circle and you have to go with sort of intermediate steps of upgrading at source with some kind of de facto tenure like they did in Medellin or whatever. The other big issue for the urban informal, and this is a plea to the whole group, is that we were good for a while of looking at rural livelihoods and rural commons. And we have to take the analog and look at the public land and public space as a public common, a public good, that we need to figure out how it gets used. And so far in urban planning, not just local economic development, there has been very little, if any, recognition of the need to use public space for livelihoods. You know, people think about bicycle routes and green for leisure and all of that, but livelihoods has not been entered into the equation. So public space as well as slum upgrading.
Hello. Eric Gutierrez from Christian Aid. Thank you for an excellent presentation, especially the call for resisting the stigmatization. We've done, in this regard, we've done some case studies on the illegals.
And, on what?
On I'm the sorry. Illegals. No? You were
yes,
talking
the
about
illegals. Right.
Yeah. And one of our case studies showed that in Afghanistan, for example, the opium growing mm-hmm. is actually contributing about 400,000 jobs, full-time jobs in the economy. Mm-hmm. It's the major export of Afghanistan, and it has converted over 265,000 hectares of desert land into agricultural land. So, you know, they are illegal, you know, it's opium growing is of course an illegal activity, and yet, you know, it also has this kind of a huge contribution to you know, to this economy. So, you know, I just would like to expand that plea on, you know, destigmatization and the you know, that, you know, they shouldn't be criminalized because many of those farmers have no option but to go into the opium economy, and you know, that's the conditions that they face. So, it's just you know, so just if you can have some comments about that expanding that. Plea for de-stigmatization and decriminalization of those types of livelihoods.
Thank you very much. It's an important example that we have to look at the incentive structure for why people will produce things that are then the state wants them produced for certain reasons, but the state rules that that's illegal. Because somebody's making that dividing line of what's illegal, what's informal, what's formal, right? And sometimes it's the state encouraging, let's say, opium production, but also at the same time labeling it as illegal or criminal. So I think there's a need to really look at the sort of structural environment in which people undertake activities that border on illegal or immoral. We have the same thing with sex workers. How do we think about them? But an important example.
Hello, I'm Hubert Schmitz from IDS. Hello.
Oh,
hello,
hi.
Marty. Hi.
Hi.
Marty, my question is, who drives the change? You mentioned some fascinating examples from India, where the informal economy is beginning to play a bigger role in the green economy, particularly through recycling.
Right.
In those cities that, you know, show us the way forward, who was behind the change that made these cities move towards contracting these informal operators? And who in the majority of other cities blocks such change from occurring? Do we know? Or do you know?
We do quite a bit. Thank you, Hubert. The region of the world where waste pickers have been organized for the longest time and have had the most success with local governments is actually Latin America. And my theory is that it's because the cities of Latin America modernized sooner than the cities in Asia or Africa and began to squeeze out the waste pickers sooner. And these successes have become about because the waste pickers are organized. They are organized mainly into cooperatives, but also could be trade unions or associations of various kinds. So in Bogota, Colombia, where we see a current success now in jeopardy, but that's the further politics I'll just come to, the organization fought 20 years legal battles to be recognized as environmental agents that have a right to access waste, that have a right to get a contract from the city to recycle waste. They had allies along the way. There were pro bono lawyers and a wonderful philosopher who called waste picking the profession of the 21st century and laid out what it means to be a profession. But it was really the workers themselves being organized. Now, the resistance in the case of Bogota is that in a previous administration had completely privatized solid waste management and issued contracts over $1 billion to a handful of companies over 8 years. And the mayor that decided to honor the constitutional court ruling that the waste pickers got and take back a certain percentage of those private contracts has been hounded out of office by the vested interests. So in some of the sectors, there is very big money. There's big money not just in the contracts for solid waste management, but there's big money up the recycling chain in those sectors. And of course, there's the big battle everywhere in the cities is around the urban land, right? So the street vendors have been working for, you know, 300 years in one place in a city, 4,000 of them. I'm talking about Ahmedabad, India, in this case. It happens to be an area right in front of the old fort. So in 1411, when the Sultan established the fort, it was his park. And the city decided to make it into a heritage park, right? So suddenly 4,000 vendors are not relocated anything. They just are not allowed to vend in this area. So there are serious competing interests for especially the inner land. And for each sector, who's in the competition is slightly different. But the organizations are up against this every day. So we're quite attuned to the political economy of this. But it takes organization of the workers. It doesn't happen without it.
Hi, Vincent Ganey from DFID. Sorry, I'm a little hoarse.
Oh, hi, okay, hi. Yes.
You made the links between the informal economy and green growth. I'd sort of question some of the validity of those links. Surely the green choices that are being made by people in the informal economy are choices that are a result of their poverty. They're not making deliberate green choices around their energy usage, around the transport systems they use, around the type of jobs they use. Waste picking is not necessarily a career of choice. It's a career that's forced upon you through your poverty. And I'm wondering whether, if we're talking about the role of the informal economy providing the sort of the foundation of the economy and the way that it can contribute to a growing economy, whether as people become more economically productive and are able to start to grow their own personal economies and improve their livelihoods, those choices are likely to change. They're likely to choose different energy options, they're likely to choose different transport options, which are probably likely to be less green. So I'm wondering about this sort of, it's a kind of accidental green choice rather than a deliberate choice or a deliberate sort of connection between green growth and informality.
I think I partly agree. And certainly there are constraints on these livelihoods. And it's not just by reason of their being poor and not having the capital to invest and expand. It's also because of this wider institutional environment that constrains them. We just finished a three-city study on technology use. And one of the findings that most surprised us, and we work on the ground a lot, was how much the confiscation of technology and equipment discouraged by local authorities, discouraged the working poor from investing. So it wasn't the lack of capital, it was the fear of confiscation and theft. And that's because they work in the inner city, but they live, let's say, in a township or at some distance, and there's no storage space. Nothing has been planned or designed for them to be able to increase their stock and then the systems that they will end up using, even if they move up the informal chain, will depend on decisions made by the city and other authorities on what kind of transportation system is in place. And it'll depend on what kind of energy system and how regular it is, what the expense is. And so some of those choices are not made by the individual informal workers. And I think what we can learn about the current, let's say, green economy by necessity, as you're suggesting, we could learn from that and try to integrate into our planning these more green options that people are using and try to think it through. One of the things we've learned about transport is there's a very good study on mass transport in Bangkok and how informal workers get around. And the conclusion is that it's class transport, not mass transport, and that the informals in Bangkok, with all of the bus rapid transport, the SkyTrain, the motorcycle drivers, are either commuting on foot or they're buying their own motorcycles, because they not only have to commute to work, they have to carry goods here and there. And the whole transport, none of the transport systems are affordable for them as individuals, much less them and their goods. So I think that's where we need to step back and really think through, if this is the broad base of the economy, how does it work and what do they need? Not just put a SkyTrain to replace cars.
Thank you. Thank you, Marty. My name is Graham Dixie. I used to work for the World Bank. I found it a great talk because it set out very clearly, you know, the different parts of the informal economy. But the question in my mind at the end of it was, well, does the informal sector provide a route out of poverty? Or is it just mainly a place that is holding people in a rather hand-to-mouth existence? And if it is a route out, what's the kind of advice that we should be giving to policymakers? What do we know that really works?
Thank you. We don't know for a fact how much of the informal economy is pure survival and how much is, sort of dynamic. We know that there are different parts and different degrees of dynamism and potential for working your way out of poverty. I think the main issue of concern is that the ability of these of the working poor in the informal economy to work their way out of poverty, no amount of supply-side interventions are going to do it unless we look at the institutional environment, unless we look at demand, look at government procurement of waste, for instance. And that's what we mean by integrating them into all of the plans for the city or for the rural areas, for that matter, so that they have more opportunities to grow their businesses. We do know, the data show, that less than 5% of informal workforce in most countries are employers who hire others. The big bulk is people who are self-employed but don't hire others. They're either the heads of a family farm or a family firm or single-person operators. The only region where you have closer to 10% of informal workers hiring others is East Asia and a little bit in Southeast Asia. But I don't think that's because they don't have financial services or business development skills. I think what we learn again and again is there's such barriers, such disincentives. In Accra, Ghana, the street market trade has a particular feel for me, and Sally Rovers, back there, is our street vendor expert. But what you have there is you have some built markets for the market traders and the market queens, and you have a lot of street vendors. And the street vendors are particularly mobile. It just seems that they just are carrying their stuff on their head and moving. In other places, I know India best, there are these natural markets where they have been vending forever, and so they go to their place every morning. They know where they're going. But why are they moving around and keeping only as much stock as they can put on their head is because of the local authorities. They have to keep a watchful eye at every moment to where the police are. I remember in Pisa, Italy, at the end of a day, meeting this group of Bangladeshi street vendors. And I worked in Bangladesh. I speak Bangla, so I was intrigued. And they huddled around, and they were selling these pathetic toys. And they looked really worn and were missing teeth. I mean, it was really hard living in Italy doing this work. And suddenly, in the middle of a conversation, they just were gone, right? Because, sure enough, coming down the street was the police. So, I mean, I think we have to really look at the institutional environment and decide whether we just want to sweep it away, pretend it doesn't exist, and have our little islands of prosperity and surrounded by a sea of despair, or whether we really want to integrate them into economic planning.
George Verghese from Development Alternatives in India. I'd like to highlight a trend that is happening in the last 3-4 years. The bridge between the formal and the informal sector. This is mobile-based applications that are turning up every day. And it's not government, it's the new age social enterprise and the new age social entrepreneurs. For example, all of us sitting in this room know what Uber is. It's basically an aggregation service. Now, the trend that is taking place in India, especially over the last 3-4 years, is these young social entrepreneurs are starting up these aggregation services. So, for example, plumbers who were completely informal once upon a time, electricians, carpenters. So these people whom it was so difficult to get. Even in the rural areas, what's happening is agricultural tools, agricultural implements, just because of mobile-based applications, it's becoming business. Now, from a policy perspective, what's happening, it's much better than getting them registered under a regulatory body. Just because they come onto the mobile applications, now you can start providing social services to them. Social security systems for them can be established. So I'd just like to highlight that right up front, rather than just taking it from a government policy perspective.
We've also been tracking the use of ICTs in the informal economy, and I do agree that it's quite amazing what, with just a simple phone, there's some applications that are being used, or just a simple phone without applications, what it can do in terms of getting orders from a buyer. One other thing is they call to suppliers to see whether the supplier has stock, saving themselves a trip if the supplier doesn't have stock that particular day. So I think there's all kinds of applications of very simple mobile phone technologies that are beginning to work, and including this sort of aggregation of people by trade so that they can find the get matched to where there's demand.
Marty, we probably just have time for 2 more questions. So I have Ty here, and we have a gentleman there, and then we will have to wrap up. So.
Okay. Thanks, and thank you very much. That was very interesting. I'm Ty Gagan, and I'm here representing the Caribbean Natural Resources Institute, based in Trinidad. Thinking about informal activities in the Caribbean context, no one in the Caribbean works a single job. Everybody has multiple occupations, and some of those occupations may be very formal, but they still have informal activities that they do alongside those. Many people work multiple informal jobs, especially the poor. And in a sense, that strategy is a substitute for a non-existent state social protection system. It's a sort of a do-it-yourself family or community level system of social protection. And I think we talked earlier about some of the structural issues, and I think this is another one of the structural issues, that system actually, it's not ideal, but it kind of works for people, and it has worked for generations. If the state sees that as a functioning alternative, they have no incentive to create adequate social protection to change that system. So it's kind of, I don't expect you to respond. If you do, that's great. But it's also an observation just to throw into the discussion for today.
Thank you. Yes, two comments. One is that, of course, the labor force statistics that we have is based on what the respondent says is the primary source of income, right? So if we added all the secondary activities that people have that tend to be in the informal economy, it becomes even larger. And in the policy debates, there has been a notion that if you target the informal economy with social protection, two things that have come up in the mainstream debates. One is that you may dislodge these existing systems of informal support and social protection and other. And the other is that you're creating a perverse incentive for people to remain informal. And in those debates, our position has been, one of our colleagues from Peru puts it, yeah, sure, there are mutual societies and they help, but it's like people being anemic and giving each other blood transfers, right? It isn't the best system. And the other is in terms of targeting the informals and creating perverse incentives. It's a normative statement, but what's more perverse, letting the majority of the workforce not have legal and social protections or offering them some social protections? And the other part of that answer is that the workers themselves know that under the current system, they are under the punitive arm of the law of the state. They want to be under the protective arm. They know they already pay some fees and some bribes and some taxes. They're willing to pay them, but they want the protection, right? So even if we regulate and tax them, they are going to want social protection as well. So I think we have to get beyond the notions of these perverse outcomes of legal and social protection for the working poor.
Thank you. Final question, if we can.
Yeah. Good morning. My name is Philip Baumgartner. I work for the International Fund for Agriculture Development, IFAD. Mm-hmm. And as part of that job, I'm currently part of a task team which is supposed to advise the Committee on World Food Security, so governments from different countries, on how to think about market integration of smallholders, so agriculture production smallholders. A lot of it is informality, and we know that most of agriculture produce are sold and produced in kind of informal rural economies. And the question I came to this workshop today with is actually, what can we advise governments? I mean, is it just advise them to not over-regulate? We know that food safety standards are a big issue for a lot of smallholders and squeezes them out of the market. Yeah, so I'm looking for answers of how make them, well, is there proactively something they should be doing rather than just cautioning governments to not over-regulate?
My feeling is that what we need to tell governments about, let's say, food security, is that informal workers like the street vendors in Accra, they want to be regulated and managed in a way that it isn't chaotic and there aren't these punitive. And we have to understand that the food is produced by smallhold farmers and agricultural laborers. It comes into the cities in these markets that nobody, the city doesn't provide any infrastructure services, right? And they're expecting informal workers to deal with all of the health concerns of the general public and also their own occupational health and safety. So it's regulate and manage. So it's, you know, if you have this huge wholesale market where all the commodities come in from the rural areas and you don't provide shelter, you don't provide infrastructure services, there is no water, there are no toilets, that's a government responsibility to manage and provide. So it's always regulation and support. It's a balance of the two. But they do want regulation so that it's not so chaotic. But they also want the support that is that would come with that.
Thank you, Marty. Thank you. Please join with me in thanking Marty, not just for this presentation, but for decades of leadership on the work you've done. We're very grateful for you to be here with us today. Thank you, Martin. Thank you.